Karoke, how's everything going?
Great, Jamie. Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you on this podcast. Thank you for joining. Obviously, you've been doing a lot with Bitcoin. But for the viewers that don't know too much about you, can you give us a little bit of a background on what you do and what you're doing?
Yeah, for sure. And it looks like you're sporting the A&M Bitcoin shirt.
I am. There you go.
Yeah, awesome. Fabulous to see that. So I'm a professor at Texas A&M. Been here for about since 2016. I'm an economist by training. I teach in the Mays Business School. So my little bit of backstory: I grew up in the East Coast of the U.S. I went to the University of Chicago for college, studied math, then got my PhD in economics. Then I was working again as a faculty at the University of Chicago for a few years, and I took a year out to join the Bush White House during the financial crisis, and that was where I saw, I think, the failures of the financial system really up close and the government's response. And so I advocated hard to limit the bailouts, but was successful in the beginning, not so much at the end. that was 2007, 2008. And so right around the birth of Bitcoin, I went back into academia. I've been teaching at Georgetown for several years. And then I came to the promised land of Texas in 2015. and I've been teaching at Texas A&M ever since. Last year, I started the long process of teaching the first Bitcoin-only class, I believe, at any university. As you know, there are blockchain classes, but for a dedicated Bitcoin class, was the first one here at Texas A&M, inspired primarily through your book, Programming Bitcoin, which is the textbook for the class. And so it's been a great run this year. I taught in the spring and also in this fall. And so it's been a fabulous, fabulous journey so far.
Okay, so the first question I think we need to get out of the way is you're an econ professor. And, Programming Bitcoin is a computer science kind of textbook. How did that work? And how are you as an economist slash, math person able to teach that?
Yeah. Okay. So this goes back into somewhat of my unique history, partly overlaps with yours. So, I have always loved O'Reilly books. I mean, that's how I obviously how I learned everything about coding. So when I was a kid, I would read all through. I would go to the Borders at the time, before there was Amazon, there was like a Borders, and they had a wall of computer books. And I would, as a kid, read the computer books. I read Learning Perl was my first book that I read. Programming Perl was the second one. And I did this in college where, ironically, my main job for 2 years after my sophomore and junior years was to be a programmer at the Federal Reserve of all places. It's a weird irony that that I was just paying the bills because I was a math major. I wanted to be in D.C. I had family there at the time, and so I applied for a job as an econ minor. So I got a job at the Fed, and I was programming all day, basically. So I basically put programming aside for a good 20 years, actually, and to be totally honest, like, your book is what brought me back, and when I was a math major, I had to take a bunch of computer science. I took we did Lisp and C++. Those are the two languages that we did as part of my my major. But then as an economist, you don't really need to code, at the level of Bitcoin, for sure. You just, the only coding most economists do is like using MATLAB. So some just light scripting. But I think the full story is that Michael Flaxman, our mutual friend, he was the one who has been telling me about Bitcoin for years, ever since, 2013 or so when I met him. And he sent me a draft copy of your book a few years ago. He said, "Hey, you should take a look." And I was started to read it, and I realized, wow, I don't know Python, so I had to take a full 6 months to like bring myself up to speed on Python, and then once I got there, then I read through your book, I did all the exercises, and then I wrote a bunch of my own, and at the time I said, this is really great material that I think every engineering student should know. And so I started the long process of trying to get a class approved. It is unusual, but not impossible for non-computer science professors to teach in the departments of computer science. It depends on every university. Our university allows any faculty, actually, as long as they get approved by the curriculum committee. They saw a lot of my research is in theoretical game theory, so it was like they thought, you know what, he probably knows as much coding as we do.
Well, so I mean, the follow up question for that would be like, what happened to the computer science program at A&M that they weren't interested, and then you as an outsider had to come in and teach this class?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you a little bit of that journey of what that was like. As you could guess, you know, most computer science departments have some variation of like a blockchain class. And A&M had that before I proposed a Bitcoin-only class. That class actually is not really even a coding class. It's actually more of an applied cryptography class. And they're trying to cover a lot of different things, and they don't really go into any detail on any one of those coins. And so, you know, Stanford has one of these classes, MIT does. And I needed to, you know, I wanted to just teach Bitcoin, and I wanted to cover it in depth and also try to cover some of the economics. And so I had to make the case for that. It was not part of our curriculum for sure. And frankly, it's not really part of any computer science department when I looked around. And so I had to, it was a little, you know, first mover advantage. I had to essentially convince the university that it was worth having a dedicated class on this. And my class got denied the first time, actually. The first time I proposed it, the committee voted it down. I asked, why is that? They could not give me a good answer. The guy, the head of the committee was nice enough. He said, you know what? Just try again. And and I did. And it went through the second time.
Well, yeah. So that's interesting to me, that there is sort of like a lot of demand for something, or there's something like blockchain. Why do you think there's a class on blockchain but not Bitcoin? What's the confusion in academia at the moment that causes that?
Well, my view on this is that it's because no one understands Bitcoin. I think even and faculty are guilty as charged. I mean, if the faculty really understood Bitcoin and what it was and how unique it is, I think they would give it much more prominence than they do now, you know. And so for the standard answer, and this came up in my original appeal for the class, was that, well, why are you picking Bitcoin among all the other technologies, right? This is just one out of like 1,000 cryptocurrencies. Like, you know, they were like, why not just have another, you know, class on so-and-so? And so I had to make the arguments. But I think that the question itself reflects, I think, that they don't really understand what Bitcoin is. And you know, our journey as educators, I think we have to educate as many people as we can. And so I've been, you know, trying to educate my colleagues also in both the business school and the computer science department that, look, this is a really revolutionary technology. It's fascinating. It's extremely deep. There's a lot of education you can get just out of teaching Bitcoin. And I really learned that actually after teaching it for 2 semesters. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so let's get into sort of like the academic resistance or lack of knowledge around this stuff. Is there anything sort of like preventing them? Because you would figure if it's a large enough department, at least one person would be at least curious about this stuff. It just seems so odd to me that the entire computer science department, you know, I mean, there wasn't that much coding on this stuff. It's like a generic blockchain class, but there's like nobody actually curious about Bitcoin. Is there a bias or something that causes that?
Yeah, so I think there's two trends. Okay, so there's two things happening at once. One is that at a secular level, this is the raw truth about computer science education. There isn't a lot of actual teaching of coding inside of computer science programs. That's unfortunate. I mean, I think what has happened is that the faculty have basically come to the position that the students will learn this on their own after they graduate. We're just going to teach theory. And so a lot of the classes are really just theoretical classes. They're which is fine for me. You know, we both of us, we have backgrounds in math, so that's okay. But I mean, for a lot of students, there should be, I think, more actual hands-on coding. And so that I think is that's happening across the board. And then for Bitcoin specifically, what I would say is, you know, I think there's probably a subtext here that is interesting to get into, which is that, you know, academia does respond to markets and market incentives, right? And so if we think about what's been the biggest player on the economic side, it's been venture capital funding of blockchain broadly, and that loosely drives academic interest on research. And so that to me explains why all of the schools that offer blockchain classes and seminars, they're implicitly responding to the markets, the VC market that's funding this stuff. And, you know, it's probably not, you know, they won't maybe admit it to be that explicit, but certainly there's a link between what classes are offered and what A16Z is funding, right? I mean, there's definitely a correlation there.
Yeah, I remember my alma mater is Michigan. I remember getting an alumni magazine a few years ago, and the cover story was about Ripple. I was like, why are they talking about Ripple? So I wrote them back. I was like, well, you know, this is an outrage. Why are you supporting this very scammy thing? And then I found out very soon after that Ripple had donated $2 million to the computer science department, and this was one of the ways in which they paid it back. And you implied that there is some level of quid pro quo, though not very explicit. Like, how deep is that in academia, where, you know, you might have some sort of like, you know, donations in return for, you know, undergrad exposure to something or other?
Yeah, I would say it's actually not on the I've raised an innovation center from philanthropic capital, so I know a little bit about this. I mean, if the money is coming from a nonprofit or a foundation, usually there's very little restriction, and it's up to the university on what to do. The stuff that comes with the strings is the money that's connected to corporations, and I think it's you know, the truth is, like, the truth is about especially engineering funding, right? Engineering is large dollar amounts. There's a lot of relationships between industry. And I think it would be naive to say that there's no expectations of that funding once it's received by the university, because it's always a long term relationship that these faculty have. And I think it's, you know, it's a balancing act they're trying to walk. But you know, universities do respond to financial incentives like every other entity, and they're often in the game of raising money, and more money beats having less money. And so that's unfortunately the world that academia is in.
Well, I mean, just like anything in a fiat system, they seem to be worshiping the almighty dollar. What's surprising to me is that they're, you know, this seems to be the primary concern, and not, say, you know, seeking truth in, you know, like the discipline that you're in or something. That's a little bit surprising to me, given, you know, all the platitudes of the typical academic.
Yeah. I mean, I do have hope. Actually, I'm optimistic on the university, because I think there are people like, you know, like me. And so, when I offered this class, I would say I got dozens of emails. Well, not dozens, maybe a dozen emails. A dozen emails from faculty around the world who also either have wanted to or are teaching Bitcoin classes. And so I think the truth will win out in the long term. And so, you know, there's no other technology like Bitcoin that has that kind of grassroots support. And so I am optimistic. But yeah, the reality is that, you know, once you get wrapped up in this funding game, it leads you down into these ugly places.
Yeah. Well, so we talked about funding from sort of corporations and donors and so on. How much funding comes in through the normal money printing trails, student loans and things like that? And how does that affect the university curriculum?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit kind of specific to A&M, which is what I really know, and then maybe a little broader about other universities. So so for us, we probably the biggest source of funding. So I would say it's not direct money printing; it's probably more indirect. It does come from the government through the NSF. And so, for example, so the backstory on this is that Vannevar Bush, who was the dean of the College of Engineering at MIT. And the creator of the NSF, he sort of created the modern technical university, of which Michigan, Stanford, MIT, Texas A&M are all in that vintage. And that created this like symbiotic relationship between the government and the university, where the government would sort of announce priorities, and it would funnel all this money to universities to execute. I think that vision actually became more extreme than even Vannevar Bush himself envisioned, because he was a deep philosopher, and he was aware of this whole system kind of getting captured. To some extent, it has, because now what happens is the role of an engineering professor is to constantly compete for the latest NSF grant, and now tenure decisions are outsourced to the NSF, where if you get a big NSF grant, you essentially get tenure. And so it's an endless game of raising in more and more money, because that money is then so it comes into the university. But the reason the university wants it is that they tax half of it as indirect cost, and that pays for the rest of the university. And so engineering is in these major engineering universities, they are the king of the hill, because they're bringing in all the money that's paying for much of the university as a whole. And so this describes, I would say, most large engineering technical universities, you know, the big R1 universities that are out there that have big engineering schools. Now, there are some specifics on, obviously there's, schools vary how much philanthropic capital they get. A&M and UT are unique because we get a lot of funding from the Permian Basin because of all the rights of the oil leases. And so that brings in a lot of revenue that pays for all our CapEx, so all our construction, which you saw when you visited. All those new buildings are paid for by oil revenue. Yeah.
Well, so let's go back a little bit, because one thing that you said just absolutely is shocking to me, that the NSF determines who gets tenure.
Yeah. That's pretty much true. That's right. I mean, what's happened is that the NSF has this pool of money that it's allocating across all universities and all top universities, and engineering faculty are competing for that money. And essentially, the role of a computer science professor today is to not just publish in journals, but really to win grants. And the amount of effort that goes into one of these grants is immense. I mean, it's as much as writing a paper itself, is just the grant proposal. And so universities essentially have kind of outsourced that performance evaluation to the NSF, because they feel like, well, it's hard enough to get an NSF grant, and once they get it, they brings in all this money, so why not have them decide?
Okay, yeah, well, I mean, that means that engineering faculty at any school is more or less determined by the NSF. So I'm curious, what criteria do they use to determine who gets a grant and who doesn't? And, like, they're kind of the kingmakers at this point, aren't they?
Yeah, they for sure are. And, I will tell you, full disclosure, I've applied to NSF grants on a team of other engineers. We've never won, okay? It's extremely hard. I don't even think it's worth the ROI. I mean, the amount of effort it takes and the payoff is not – anyway, so what I've noted – it gets into some crazy behavior. I mean, I was part of a grant for a major AI before AI became hot. A big AI grant a few years ago, and it was a $60 million grant, right? Lots of money. And it was a team of like five principal investigators and then like two dozen other co-PIs. And it was almost comical that we would spend hours on these Zoom calls and trying to figure out what words we had to do, like a one-page cover sheet. Like, what colors should be on which tab, and should we use that or which in this second sentence, and there were like an hour debate over this. And I thought, this, something has gone wrong with the system where, we have got all these PhDs, essentially trying to make these small tweaks. And that's really what's happened, because the NFSF has a lot of power in the academic market, and they do fund, it's really the scarcity that from their funding, which gives then prestige to the university when, a faculty gets a grant. And so, that's literally the system that we're in now. Yeah.
Okay. So you don't get any clarity into how they evaluate it. So do they publish anything saying like, here's the criteria, or, if you do this, you might have a better chance? Like, what? Like, this is what determines the faculty at every engineering school, and we have no idea what the criteria are. So I'm curious if they publish anything or say anything to you guys.
Yeah, so they do announce, you know, the mm-hmm. previous winners. I don't know exactly how much they disclose, like which mm-hmm. grants have won, but most mm-hmm. major universities do have enough faculty who have mm-hmm. gotten these grants, and so they do help you out. So, mm-hmm. for example, when we were applying for the $60 million grant, our university had another $60 million grant that we won a few years ago, and those guys mm-hmm. showed us their grant. They showed us like how they did it, and mm-hmm. it's a long process. I mean, part mm-hmm. of it, I can tell you what I know from that experience. Part of it mm-hmm. is academic. They look at all your papers, your research. Then they evaluate your proposal. It's broader mm-hmm. than just research alone, so they want to see social impact, which is part mm-hmm. of the criteria now. Mm-hmm. But then they have all this other stuff. I mean, if it's a big enough grant, they make site visits. They, mm-hmm. you know, you have to kind of show them your students, your facilities. Mm-hmm. So they do try to do a thorough job. I'm not mm-hmm. on the committee, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there are, you know, what happens is faculty do rotate. So they mm-hmm. they actually the judges for the NSF are faculty who are at other universities, and they rotate in and out.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So they come in and out of this system depending on like where they are in their career, I guess.
Yeah, exactly right. That's right. Yeah. So you can, as a faculty, you can then spend a year at the NSF, and then you go on the other side of the table and then decide on grants, because they need experts to make these decisions. They don't, you know, which is good. I think it's good that they're not just doing it on their own. But then, you know, you could say maybe that creates some perverse incentives, kind of this revolving door. And so, so you got to kind of pick your poison.
Well, I, as an economist, how does that strike you? And what sort of things does having a system like that encourage? Like what sort of research do they go in as a result of that?
Yeah, I think the first order problem is that the NSF has gotten too big. I mean, and it's really like I think Vannevar Bush I think his original vision was for basic science, right? Mm. Just the R of R&D. But what's happened with the NSF is now turned into the D of R&D and all this applied research, which doesn't really matter for – there's no reason why universities should be actually the ones doing this. Mm. And so it's bloated the scale and scope of higher education, because now universities are doing stuff that should be occurring in the private sector. So I think that's a first-order problem with just the general funding of science funding. No university president has an incentive to say this or even acknowledge this, because they're measured based on their dollars that they bring in through the door. And so it's like this endless race to the, you know, how much money can you bring in? And that's what engineering faculty end up doing. And you know, I'll give you an example. I mean, some of our colleagues in mechanical engineering, they were working on these projects. They were writing these big proposals for funding of autonomous vehicles. And they were really – I mean, they were literally building an autonomous vehicle out of a university lab, which to me, I think it should have just been done in like at a company like Tesla rather than on campus. Mm. Yeah. So –
Okay. So –
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, so that's the first order problem is that there's the mission of the NSF has gotten too large, and now it's created this what you could call it like the educational industrial complex, which is, you know, it mirrors like the military industrial complex.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds more like the science industrial complex, because it determines what research you're going to do. So what sort of biases does this introduce in terms of what research gets funded and so on? I imagine something politically popular would be more likely to get a grant or something. Is that true, or is that like just like my speculation here?
Well, I would say insofar as the NSF follows politics, I think more likely what's happening is the NSF is following the market. And so right now, for example, AI is the market is chasing AI, and so is therefore the NSF. And so the NSF is now funding all this new proposals are coming out the door for generative AI, right? I mean, this is not an accident, right? It just it's kind of in lockstep with the market. So that I think is the downside. They do have funding for still basic science, but that funding, those numbers are much smaller than the large grants. Like the big grants are, they call it, you know, these big social, they want to change society. And so they're like interdisciplinary, multi-university grants. But, you know, I think they do kind of follow either their own priorities or they do follow the market. Yeah.
Okay. So you said like the bigger grants have a bigger impact or something like that? Like what's like, like a normal basic science grant versus like the really huge grants, I guess, that you guys are going, that most professors go for?
Yeah, so I think for an individual faculty, anything from like 300,000 to a million is like a good size for because it's a multi-year grant that can support their lab and many students. Once you get into multi-millions, that's when it's larger than one faculty, usually a team of faculty. Once you clear 10 million and above, then you're getting into a, like a dedicated center. And generally, if you hit, if you clear 20 or 30 million, then you're dealing with multiple universities.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So
in terms of the scale, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And the like, what are the projects like at each level? Like, I can't imagine like what a multi-university grant would be like or whatever, but like, right. What, how does that look?
Yeah. So I can tell you what we know. You know, there was, we received one, A&M received one on remote health. And so they wanted to get healthcare to remote populations. A&M was the lead on that. So there was basically they were kind of the main university, and there were maybe a half a dozen other partner universities. So all these professors would kind of utilize their labs and their graduate students in their own universities. And so generally what they do is like these are long, over 5 or 10 years. So there's like an initial year where they just kind of get the students funded, maybe host a workshop, maybe year three host a conference. And then over time, with a 10-year grant, they want to see some kind of – when they say impact, they mean like as close to a product coming out of this grant as possible, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that's
the point where it's really beginning to kind of interface with the market, you know?
Okay. But, I mean, a lot of the basic science grants, the 300,000 to a million, what are they studying that it's considered basic versus something like remote health or something like that?
Yeah. So, okay. So one of my friends and colleagues, he's an AI researcher, you know, he got a grant of about $300,000, and he's studying like reinforcement learning among multi-agent robots. And so he's researching, you know, how robots are interacting with each other using some new theory on reinforcement learning that he developed. That grant will pay for his research and his graduate students for the next several years, probably also secure his tenure decision. And so that's a kind of a standard one person, one individual grant.
Okay.
The multi-university grants they're big operations. They're, you know, obviously the university has a vested interest in getting these. They bring in lots of dollars, but again, the indirect costs, which is the money that's supporting the rest of the university, that's what the university really likes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so let's talk about the actual grant writing, because there seems to be a significant amount of effort that goes into it. And I don't think most people appreciate just how tedious it can be. Can you describe what a grant proposal looks like? Why you have to work on it so much, and you know what the process is like over years or whatever?
Okay, I can probably freely say it's a horrible process. I don't know anyone that thinks otherwise. I'm in a business school, so I'm lucky in the sense that we don't have to don't have these major labs that require these kind of grants. I've been on these grants just because I moonlight in engineering, and so I've been on two grants, and you know they were you know let's say a research paper can be 20 pages. These grants are 30 to 50 pages plus, depending the larger the grants, the more they are, and they're extremely detailed. I mean, they want to know things like not just all your research, but they kind of want you to rewrite a lot of your research. So here's an example. Let's say you have five or six papers in one area. For a journal, you never have to like summarize across six papers or 10 papers. The only time you have to do that is when you go up for tenure or when you write one of these grants. So when you write for, you have to kind of take this synthetic view, of all your work together and craft a narrative that fits the research, and then also point it towards a direction that they kind of are aligned on, and then fit it in, if it's a larger multi-university, fit it in with the narrative of what the other universities are doing, why this is important, and so on. So it's a lot of storytelling. That's part of it, and it's a lot of just gathering a large amount of information together. And the third is you have to sometimes do kind of like bespoke analysis for the grant. So maybe you have some research project that illustrated something that's adjacent to the grant, they would want to see that you apply that knowledge to this problem as to say that, okay, you're actually a credible person to be funding.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. In essence, you have to be like an English major, I guess, to write this stuff and like get it exactly, and still you don't know. You still might get rejected. So it's really based on like whoever the evaluators are on how they feel or how hungry they are when they read your proposal.
That's right. That's right. And you know what generally happens is that faculty start specializing in certain areas. So like some faculty will be known for just being a great grant writer. Like that guy can write the introductions. He knows how to, you know, kind of aim it like a cruise missile right into the NSF sweet spot. So he's on all the grants, right? So he gets on all these grants. And there's other people who are just great at the back end, just making charts and graphs. So yeah, I've seen that.
So there's probably a lot of aspiring technical writers that could probably get like a tenure track position just by like writing really good grant proposals. I think what I'm hearing.
Yeah, in fact, if the grants get large enough, this is another part of it. You could say it's the bloat of higher education. There's dedicated staff whose job is called like grant writer, and all they do is write grants for places like the NSF, and that's their job, and they know this process. And when the grant is big enough, you will have a grant writer who is there to really kind of put all the pieces together into this massive package. Yeah.
That's crazy. Never knew there was such a variety among faculty like that. You just do grants, and all you're going to do is write that.
There is one more subtext I want to mention that it has to do with immigration. And actually, What is happening now is, and I've written about this elsewhere, is that essentially higher education, especially science education, is the portal for high-skilled immigration into the U.S. What's like all the major tech companies, not even just in software, but hardware also, they realize that there's a skills gap in the U.S. and so they don't want to, for whatever reason, they don't want to hire directly from foreign countries like India and China, and so they hire through through universities. And so this kind of bothers me the most about this whole grant process is that a lot of these grants fund students who eventually they're funded on these large government grants at taxpayer expense, right? And they then eventually just join the like big tech, right, or other jobs in the mainstream. So you could say taxpayers are implicitly subsidizing the human capital and the training of the big technology companies. And to me, it just doesn't make any economic sense why this is happening and why more people don't talk about this. I mean, Facebook or others, I don't want to just, name one, but they all do this. They could easily bear the cost of these, the training themselves, but it goes through this kind of this kind of backwards process of, the NSF is essentially funding these grants. The grants are paying for graduate students. Majority of these graduate students, unless you're at like a top 3-4 school, the majority of the graduate students do not take academic jobs. They either go to industrial labs or to the private sector.
Oh, wow. And the private sector in this case are the big tech companies.
Exactly right. Okay. And, it's almost a waste. I mean, I've been on – I even have papers with some very smart PhD students. They were great researchers. They could have done a lot with basic science, but then they get the job offer from Facebook or Amazon at year five, and they just leave. And the engineering faculty doesn't seem to care about this. Like they've sort of kind of done their duty during those 5 years, but to me it tells you a little bit that the incentives are misaligned at the system.
Yeah. Well, so they don't finish up their PhD. They leave in year five.
No, they do. So five is kind of the average, yeah. So they would finish their PhD and then leave, yeah.
And then leave for these companies, even for if they're companies. In basic science or something like that, if they have a PhD in physics.
Yeah, exactly. As long as they can code in Python. So they really just take a Python test, and as long as they pass that, and it's at the level of an undergraduate test, basically, and then they get hired as a software developer, and that's their and this is the port of entry for most large technology companies. Yeah,
they're using the PhD program as like a filter for whether or not you're smart enough to, I guess, join one of these companies.
That's
something
right.
Like that.
That's exactly right. That's right. Well,
That's
well,
right.
So yeah. how efficient do you think that, I mean, like, obviously you don't think it's very efficient at all, but like, do they end up being good employees for, you know, Google, Facebook or Netflix or whoever? Like, or like, do you think there's it speaks to where the money is, right? Like these big tech companies, and they can probably offer very generous packages and so on. But like what how inefficient is it? Like, are they hired for no reason almost, or just to hoard labor? What's your impression?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say I think if someone does a 5-year PhD and they join a big tech company in a sort of generic software role, that to me seems inefficient, because they're not really doing anything with their degree. They're not utilizing any of their research or doing any. I mean, I'm not talking about someone who gets a PhD in cryptography and then joins like Blockstream. I'm talking more about someone who gets a PhD in physics, right, and then just joins Tesla as a physicist or just as a base level coder. And this still does happen more often than you'd think, and so that is to me, it's a little bit of a shame when that happens. At the master's level, it's definitely happening in full force. I mean, but master's is a little different because they're not funded by the government; they're more paying the university. So there's still this kind of conduit of into big tech via the immigration process, but it's going. The master's students are essentially paying their way through.
But the PhD students are funded by the NSF or somebody
else?
Yeah,
that's right. Okay. Yeah. PhD students, they all need funding. No one really pays for their PhD. So they all get funding somehow, and that almost always comes through these grants, through the NSF, yep.
Okay, so this is, I suspect, like hard sciences and engineering and stuff like that. I mean, there are PhDs in other subjects. Do they have to go through the same process? What's the deal there?
Yeah, so they do not. Yeah, the good news is that they don't. I mean, so in social sciences, for example, psychology, business, there's no government grant proposal writing. I mean, depends, like history. Generally, the other fields are, you could say, they're self-funded, so they're funded through their general appropriations that their department has. And that tends to limit the size of the programs. I mean, in the business school, we have maybe 2 or 3 PhD students in our department per year. You know, that, whereas in engineering, one faculty might have 2 or 3 PhD students that year for themselves. You know, so the scale, it sort of naturally imposes some discipline on the hiring process. Yeah.
Okay, and all of this NSF funding, is it appropriated by Congress? Is it is it part of the executive? Like, how do they determine what the budget for that is going to be, and how much are we talking about with NSF?
Yeah, so my data is going to be a little bit off the a little out of date, but I want to say that the last I looked at it, which was a while ago, maybe 5 years ago, I mean, it was around the order of, I think, $30 billion was the NSF budget, and
per year,
per year, yeah, and it actually an equal amount. The reason I remember that $30 billion number, the equal amount is the NIH budget. So the health budget itself, of health funding from the government, is as big as all other funding, and I haven't kept up on what the actual numbers are now, but they're roughly on that order. Yeah, so that's coming from Congress, an act of Congress. I don't know specifically how I haven't worked on this at this level of detail. I don't know how the appropriations work, but yeah, roughly on that order of magnitude. Yeah.
So in a sense, I think what you're saying is that Congress is subsidizing the big tech companies by giving them labor getting them labor from foreign countries through these NSF grants. That's not a subsidy that I would have ever thought of, but it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, not just big tech. I would say the private sector are broadly defined. Yeah. So I would say that let's think about the numbers, right? Like the numbers of PhD students, these grants are big, right? So the grants are big. The number of PhD students they admit is large. There just aren't that many academic jobs for all these students. So the PhD students have to go somewhere. And the two chief targets for most PhD students in science and engineering are going to be industrial labs or the private sector. And so there's just too many. They're admitting too many students, and they're for the private, ultimately getting employed by the private sector. Yeah.
So would you say that the population is generally a little bit overeducated for sort of the needs of the economy, like as an economist, I guess?
Yeah, well, I would – well, they're certainly overeducated for that job that they're getting hired for. Again, rarely does that use the specific details of their dissertation. You know, they could have basically gotten that job after, you know, as a – like after their first year of their PhD student, but they, you know, kept going the whole way. But I think the bigger inefficiency is that the private sector can easily pay for these students. You know, they can easily they just don't want to, right? And they're in this cushy relationship where they don't have to pay for they don't have to pay for the general human capital that essentially is being borne by American taxpayers. That's what to happen. Who's paying for the NSF? It's taxpayer dollars, right? So that's the inefficient, that's the distortion, right? And so what that means is that companies like Tesla and Amazon and everyone else, even like Ford and GM, all these companies that hire these PhD students are getting them on the cheap because they're getting a lot of their general human capital paid for by the population as a whole, where and they're capturing all the returns of that on the tail end. So that's that's the distortion.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, so let's switch gears a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
How has reception for your class been on campus and in the university?
Yeah, so I would say on campus among students, it's been phenomenal. So the students have been very happy. They felt like this was the first time that they felt like there was a class that was actually relevant for them, that was kind of about something that was important, that they knew about, that they heard about. None of them knew about what Bitcoin was. I was really surprised. This is why I've told you, there's a lot of books you could write because the knowledge of Bitcoin is so preliminary among even technical computer science students. And so the students were just very, very grateful that this was around. I'd say the university so far has been neutral. So parts of the university have been positive, parts have been negative. I think on average it's been neutral. I'll give you some examples. Like the good parts are that the business school donated a 1 terabyte hard drive to each student to be able to run their own full node. So that was great. That was really nice of them. I don't think that was like a principal decision. I think it was just that they had a bunch of laptops that they weren't using. And I asked them, hey, can I just use these? They're like, yeah, sure, why not? And so that they don't. On the downside, I feel like the university is still not supporting it the way I would want them to. They're still not allocating enough resources to it. They're not, it's not a priority for them. It's more, it's a nice to have, but their priority is right now in engineering, for example, just getting core classes filled, which I understand. But this is not a core. They don't see this as a core class, and so it's an elective. And so for them, their core classes come first. And so it's still. I've also tried to get this. I taught a business Bitcoin class also that you spoke in last month, a few weeks ago. That I want. I'm trying to get that part of the tech program in the business school as a required class, and I'm in the process of making that pitch. But it's an uphill battle. I will say that because right now that program is trying to place undergraduates into companies like Facebook and Amazon, and so they don't see Bitcoin as part of that process. And so again, this is the lack of, I think, they just don't understand Bitcoin and how important it is. So that's part of the cross that I bear, which is trying to educate them about this technology as a whole. Yeah.
Well, there seems to be sort of like moneyed interests here that, and the incentives are such that they, I guess what determines undergraduate satisfaction is being able to get a job at one of these big companies or something like that. What's surprising to me is that there's little concern for entrepreneurship or people starting their own stuff or creating their own things. Is that a priority at a university, or is it more like you can be a cog for this machine or something like that?
Yeah. So you've hit on what I think is probably the most fundamental problem, I think, with higher education today. I mean, frankly, I think it's even bigger than the grant problem. And it is that the higher education has just too high a time preference. And their objective is just to place as many students into jobs as possible, right? They're trying to maximize their starting salary of the jobs, number of placements and the starting salary. If you look at the funding for higher education, for example, the donors, right? The donors behind all of the universities, they are largely entrepreneurs because that's the upper tail of the income distribution.
Yeah.
And so you'd think the rational choice would be for the university to take a long view, adopt some low time preference, and invest in the next generation of entrepreneurs. But it is embarrassing to me how little universities do for this and how much they do for getting a kind of being a cog in a wheel. You land at Texas A&M, either in engineering or in business, and there is a very clear path for you to get a job at Lockheed or at NASA or at PwC or at Deloitte. If you want to, make your own way, you're really on your own. Some of that's changing. Some of that is changing. But, and I started my innovation center at A&M to help solve that problem. But it's, relatively, we have such a small numbers compared to the size of the problem.
And is this a common thing at every university, or is it like specific to A&M because of all the, I guess, Permian Basin money or something like that?
I think it is common. I know this because there's an annual conference, the Global Center for Entrepreneurship Centers, the Global Conference of Entrepreneurship Centers. It's an annual conference where all these centers for innovation and entrepreneurship gather every year. And we all kind of complain about the same thing. Like, why are we kind of this small persecuted minority when this is the engine of value creation for the whole economy? So there's like this total mismatch. All these universities are still, everyone's trying to figure it out. But at a scale level, there's a massive underinvestment, I think, of entrepreneurship education and entrepreneurship practice relative to the social value that entrepreneurs play in society.
Well, it's interesting that you use that phrase, we're still trying to figure it out. I mean, most universities are at least 100 years old.
Yeah.
What's going? Shouldn't you have figured it out by now?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And, I don't know. I was fighting this battle a few years ago, and then I decided let me just focus on Bitcoin these last 2 years because it seemed like a little bit more narrow. But you're right. The big problem is universities haven't figured it out. I mean, it's still they're still playing this game of just trying to maximize the maximize the outcome for the average student. Really, rather than really helping the kind of all students or even the best students, when you just try to place at a job, I think it rewards a certain kind of student and behavior. And it my problem is that there are kids I see who have a lot of entrepreneurial ability and skills, and maybe they're not the best in the classroom, but they can really hustle or code, and they should be rewarded and supported, and not just kind of left by the wayside, which is how it is now.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you say that, the university is essentially a high time preference institution. How much does debt play into that? Because, if it's like 10,000 over 4 years, you're probably able to, gamble a little bit more and try entrepreneurship. Whereas, if you have a debt of $200,000 over 4 years, well, now there's a lot more urgency to pay that off, and getting a good job means being able to pay it off. Like, how much of it is related to debt?
I think the debt story really matters at the private schools, and so especially the second tier private schools. And so I was teaching at Georgetown and George Washington before this, and George Washington, for example, had a tuition as high as Harvard, right? These are very, very expensive schools, and not every parent is able to pay for all these. Some mix of financial aid, lots of student loans. For sure, debt has a huge impact on those students and their career choices. I think the honest truth is I don't think debt is that impactful at A&M. Partly our tuition is much lower. I think it's more – it's kind of this culture of risk aversion that I think – I don't know why, but that seems to be if I had to say what it was. At the private schools, I think especially the second-year private debt is a big issue. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that they still have this kind of like high time preference or they perceive it as less risk to go to a large company than to try something on their own. That something seems a little bit strange about that, but then maybe 12 years of schooling before college has something to do with it, and I imagine your students are pretty smart or did well in high school to get into A&M. So how much of that is just sort of like their history and the education system that comes before university?
Oh, I think the problem is pretty deep, and it goes back pretty far. I mean, as soon as you get to campus, the social pressure and I guess the social community is all around kind of getting a job, the cog in a wheel job. I mean, getting a job at a major company, and that's what's happened is that's what all the students see. That's what they observe, and that's what they end up wanting. And even though we have speakers come in who are entrepreneurs like yourself and others, it's still a very small minority towards the machine that comes in from the major industries. And so I'll give you one example. Okay, simple example. Like the Student Engineering Council. Like this is the main council for all engineers at A&M. We're like the largest engineering school in the U.S. We have 70,000 students overall, 20,000 in engineering alone. This group is a group of students of about 20 students who organize all events for other engineering students. Part of that, what they do is they do a career fair. And so they bring in all these companies for this career fair. And they do it all themselves, which is pretty impressive, right? But they don't bring in really any startups, you know? And part of it is that the students who are doing this on their own, they, you know, like Microsoft will have like a dedicated campus recruiter whose job is to like go to campuses. But if you're a startup in Austin, you know, Unchained Capital doesn't have someone whose job is to do this, right? So so then the startups get totally left out. And so there's a bunch of things that lead to this community effect of all the roads are pointing toward the yellow brick road is pointing towards the big company, and that leads to, I think, this risk aversion. And it's a big issue. It's not easy. It's not exactly easy how to change that. I mean, it's. I think people have. I have some ideas. There are others who have ideas, but yeah.
Well, is it specific to A&M or is that more generalizable? Is it like if you go to another engineering school, would that still be the case?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, what we're seeing is not unique to us. I mean, I know just because I've talked to some of these recruiters, they visit many universities at once. And so, I think what is considered a win for a university like A&M is that, a win for them is that like Tesla will send a campus rep to A&M this year, or kind of a more, not even a startup, but like a larger company that's not just the standard companies from the past, like not just McKinsey, but maybe like a newer big company. That would be the metric that the campus recruiting office would see as a success. Yeah.
So maybe there's a prestige around this or something that plays into it, because it really does seem like there's, I don't know, the selectivity and scarcity of these jobs or grants or whatever seems to be a major factor in how desirable they are in a university.
Yeah. So you mean the scarcity of the NSF grants?
Well, not just the NSF grants, but like the jobs at McKinsey or jobs at Tesla or something like that, being prestigious as they are, and there not being that many of them, I guess, something like that.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. You could say there's essentially a status game that's being played among the students, and probably not so much the faculty. They're a little agnostic. It's more the administration. That they want to make sure that they can say at the end, like, what's the performance of this program, this master's or undergraduate program? Well, they want to be able to say they got students into these companies that everyone has heard about. These are like the big successful companies, and that's the badge of honor. I think the shame is that you think about something like Bitcoin it's so fascinating and so technical that our like engineering students could all do it if they wanted to, and it's a shame that it kind of breaks my heart that even in my class some of the best students are now just getting a job at Deloitte doing some really generic generic work. I mean, just not that doesn't take advantage of their own talents and knowledge, And I'm not picking on Deloitte specifically. It's just, you could put any big four company there. You know?
Yeah, this whole conversation makes me a little sad because I see Texas as sort of the frontiersman and people that are willing to take risk and so on, but. What you're describing is basically the opposite.
Yeah. You're right, Jimmy. I mean, and I know that's why you wear the hat, right? Because of the spirit of Texas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, what I told the students when I talked to the engineering council is that Texas certainly was that when it started. I don't know how or when this happened, and I don't know if it came from success on the oil patch, but the risk aversion, either in the state or at least at the university level, is now at the point where we need to actively reclaim that spirit, the pioneering spirit. It's not going to happen on its own. And my view from the campus, when I walk the campus, it's not this swashbuckling, let's go out and conquer the future, the Wild West, that brought us here. And it's really now is our time that we need to remember that and recapture that.
Mm. Yeah. All right. So one last thing I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about. So I think everyone's seen like the charts of professors versus administrators since 1971. With, hospital administrators versus doctors and, nurses and people like that, that actually do the work. How bad is it? Is it continuing to grow? Is there any hope? What do they all do? I guess I think a question for anybody that's considering sending their kid to college.
No, it is pretty bad. Mm-hmm. The administrative bloat is real. I faced this in many ways when I was running my innovation center. Mm-hmm. I think there are a few different things that lead to why it's gotten so bad. One is higher education as an entity has just become this insane bureaucracy. It's especially like a state institution like UT or A&M. It's really become this octopus that has grown over time, and the bureaucratic administrative state has now like it's just enormous, and it's gotten to the point where it's ridiculous. Hiring a staff or hiring like a staff or a student is now so difficult. The number of hurdles you need to go through to get a student hired for a student worker or a student research assistant is an immense amount of time and energy. So that's one thing. And the other thing that's happened is that part of the growing size is that there's very little discipline on top level administrators to prevent them from hiring and bloating their own staff. And so what happens, this happens every year. You get a new dean, and the new dean just makes up positions, right? Just out of nowhere, they just kind of make them up. It's happened every time, every year that I've been in higher education, the last 20 years, basically, 15 years. Once a year, I'm like, oh, I didn't know that position even existed. It turns out it didn't exist, right? And there's not enough discipline from, like, really market discipline from the donors, I think, who are donors and taxpayers, those two communities, both of which are disorganized. The taxpayers, of course, they're diffuse. And the donors themselves are also diffuse. I mean, the donors could exert more discipline on the administrators, but they don't. They essentially kind of write it off as a tax donation, and they kind of don't monitor the gift anymore. And so there's a large amount of just lack of market discipline in the hiring choices. Yeah. That's led to
what do these people do? Like you're a dean, you create three new positions. What responsibilities do you give them?
Yeah, so some of them, I would say, some of the responsibilities is just handling this larger administrative red tape. And so the red tape is ballooned, and now no one wants to, like, these grant writers as an example, right? The amount of you need to hire someone just to deal with handling all these grants, and then also if you want to hire more people, you need someone dedicated HR teams, you need dedicated business teams. So there's just a huge amount of reporting. All this reporing has all these indirect costs by requiring even more people to feed the machine. Yeah. And then the other thing is, you could say CEOs do this too. CEOs have probably stronger market incentives, but every CEO might have, they could have random strategy groups, someone to think about this strategy versus that strategy. That happens too. I think our last one of the deans of our colleges from a few years ago had more associate deans than anyone, than like two or three times the number of associate deans. No one really knew what they were doing. They were all in charge of this initiative versus that initiative. And every now and then there is kind of a referendum, and there is like a slight correction, and the next president will or dean will cut it down a little bit. But the general trend has been going up. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the federal budget, right? It's constantly expanding, and then once in a while you get a slight cut, but it seems like a really kind of nightmarish process. and it's weird because that same dynamic happens at a lot of startups after you get VC money is, you know, you get a whole bunch of people that just kind of are hired, and you're like, well, I don't know what these people do. I don't know what they're here for. And then you need additional people just to manage that. And then you get like multiple layers of management or something to that effect. So,
Exactly right. That's certainly happened in higher education. I mean, I know this has been a little bit depressing, but you know, look, I love, at the end of the day, like for me, it's all about the students. The students are what keep me in this game. That's why I came to Texas. That's why I came to Texas A&M. They're the ones that won my heart. Those are the kids that I'm fighting for. You know, higher education, you could say, like money itself, is broken. But I think there are enough people. I mean, it's just like there's going to be a citizen revolt. I think faculty, I think, who care about students will want the best for their students. And I have enough faith that we will correct the system unless it completely blows up. Yeah.
Well, I mean, do you think Bitcoin's a part of that solution? Or, I mean, do you think a lot of people should maybe not consider college, especially if they're more entrepreneurial or something like that? Like, what's your advice as a professor who's been in the trenches and know about all of this to people like me who have, you know, like a kid that's about to, you know, graduate high school or whatever? Like, what's your advice?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I intellectually, I believe in entrepreneurship. I think it has huge value for the person and for society. If a kid, high school student has an idea, then my view is parents should support them. I mean, it's not my place to say, but I think there's nothing wrong with in fact, there's a lot of things right with taking a risk and pursuing your own dream and your own venture. That's probably one of the highest things a person can do to maximize both their fulfillment and their highest economic return. And so I am totally in support of that. And I feel like universities should be, and I'm trying to make them more aware of the need to support entrepreneurs going forward. I am optimistic about higher education. I think it's a very slim group of people who that I've seen so far that have the ability and the interest to become entrepreneurs. And so I think if you do go to college, you know, I think make a bunch of smart decisions. I mean, one is just price matters, right? So pay attention to what tuition prices are, and just know that you don't want to buy high and sell low, right? So you want to be aware of what you're paying for. I mean, frankly, that was one of the reasons I came to Texas. I wanted to work at a university that had a stronger balance sheet and less lower tuition cost. And so two is that your major also matters. And so that, I think we both know, like, you know, this part should not be controversial. Like, the returns to STEM education are just higher, both economically and in many ways than the other disciplines. And so those degrees cost the same, but their value is not the same. And so, you know, as a parent, my parents told me that when I was in college. I hated them for it, but they were right. So I think, and the third thing is that, you know, related to that, just, you know, I would coach your kids about making sure that they, you know, just are thoughtful about their course selection. And there's a lot of fat in the system, and it's possible to have a lot of courses that don't have a lot of value. They're still there. But, you know, I think, Jimmy, for you, I think you would know what those are. So I think just the parents need to be a little more, just, you know, suggest which classes have more value than others, which the students may not always see.
Yep. Okay, well, that's interesting to hear. So let's kind of wrap this up. Where can people find you? Where can people contact you?
Oh sure, yeah, yeah. So I am best way is I'm is you can I have a newsletter, Substack newsletter, I guess like everyone else, called Principles of Bitcoin. I also have a website that I'm creating called Principles of Bitcoin, and primarily I'm just using using, so to speak, Bitcoin as a vehicle for education, because there's so much there, so much that we can learn, not just about Bitcoin but from Bitcoin. And to answer your question, I do think Bitcoin is part of the solution. Really, from just the – it's so interdisciplinary. It's so technical. It's such a thoughtful design. It's like a magical technology, and it's just so fascinating. And I would recommend your book, my favorite book on Bitcoin, Programming Bitcoin, is a great way to – for the technical student to understand it. What I'm going to try to do is, I think there's an opportunity to reach a larger group of students, like business students, who may not know or be they may not be able to code or are scared of code, but still they deserve and they should learn about how Bitcoin works, and that's the population I want to help as much as I can.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Jimmy, and thanks for all your work educating the next generation of Bitcoiners that you've done for a decade now.
And that's something that I can say about you, too. All right, great. Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.